TFM.
Welcome, stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, it's a little bit dark in here. Do you think we could turn the lights up a little so I can be sure who's playing Matthew in this episode of...
No, you're a monster! Get away from me! You're the one who wants to destroy me and my mother and my stories.
I'm very sorry. I may be a monster, but not in the way you think. I don't know what that means for me. All right, enough of this. We're going to talk about the seventh episode of Star Trek Picard Season 2 Monsters today. And here's a quick rundown. Lying in the clinic and near death, Jean-Luc is lost in the recesses of his mind, and we're there with him. Also with him is a Starfleet psychiatrist in a late 24th century uniform. This doctor is trying to get Picard to open up, and he suggests that telling a story might help. And this takes us deep into Jean-Luc's childhood and the struggles of his mother. Joining us there is Tallinn. And as light is being shed on this psychological aspect of the story, Raffi and Seven learn of Jurati's assimilation and set out in search of the soon-to-be queen in what may be a race against time for humanity's future. Meanwhile, Rios channels Kirk as he embarks on his own voyage home. But in which century will he settle down? So, Matthew, that's one of the questions that we will try to answer today. But before that, let's talk about the meat of the story, Monsters of the Mind, and what's going on with Picard. Because as you outlined quite clearly in our last episode, yes, this was all in his mother's mind.
Yeah, I think that this is really interesting because the main question, you know, and you talked about the monsters of the mind, and the main question for Jean-Luc here is, one, who is Jean-Luc, and who is the real monster? And his misunderstanding of who the real monster has been in his life, in the sense of always thinking that it was his father who was creating the issues with his mother and not realizing, because he's a child, what's happening to his mother and the fact that she is having these mental breakdowns, which is causing this kind of immense darkness to kind of overtake her, which is leading her to be dangerous to even be around her son at those points, which makes his father look like the bad guy when he does what he needs to do to protect his son and himself from his wife when she is in these places. And, you know, one, it's gorgeous that this show kind of shows that you can't help somebody who doesn't want to be helped. And it's very clear that Picard's mother does not want the help that she needs to truly get better. And there's only so much you can do, which, of course, you know, leaves Maurice Picard in a very terrible position because it does make him look like the bad guy, especially in the eyes of a child.
Right.
And yet we have these realizations for Jean-Luc, realizing that he had blamed the wrong person. And he had not seen the true monster, which was mental illness in his mother. And I think it's a story to which I just had a lot of emotional reaction to, in all honesty, watching the episode the first time. And seeing this boy be stuck because he can't move. And Picard then being stuck in that because he can't move and we know there's more to the story, right? We know, and I would bet anybody a lot of money that we are going to find out that Picard, Jean-Luc, let his mother out of that room and she died because of it. And therefore, he has felt responsible for that death for all of these years, which is why he has stuck himself mentally in a room in which there's always a chance it could turn out differently if we just stay here mentally, which has led him then to not being open emotionally. It has led to that emotional constipation, that arrested development of the heart. And I think it's an incredibly beautiful story in the sense of and heartbreaking that this has happened to him. And I think we finally have an understanding of, you know, he talks about the queen with the fiery red hair, and mm-hmm. I'm sure everybody thought of Crusher.
Right, yeah.
First and foremost, which is why he's attracted to redheads, which I get. So there were so many answers in this episode as to what makes this character tick that they did in 7 episodes what 7 years couldn't do for the character on TNG.
Well,
which
yeah.
is a really yeah. incredible thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, because the writing style of the
and
next
I'm
generation.
And I'm not saying TNG is terrible yeah, right, because yeah. of it, but because it's not the type of television
exactly.
it was.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm just saying we actually did peel back the layers
right.
of this character finally, which is a very rewarding thing for those of us that have been with this character for so long.
Yeah, right. Yeah, the writing style of TNG was very different, so they weren't going to explore a character in this way in the first place. But they started to do it a little bit in the films. You know, they started with The Generation, and we started to learn a
right.
little bit more
right.
about who Jean-Luc was as a person. And perhaps the revelations in Generations are closer to what we're seeing here, but still, they couldn't really explore that in the format of a motion picture. And so they've done a really great job here. It really makes us think a lot about the character as we think about him over all the stories in which we've seen him. And it's been quite clear, as you say, from the beginning here that he feels guilty about something. And then as we came to mm-hmm. figure out that it had to do with his mother and perhaps mental illness, which we have been talking about for a couple of episodes now as the probable path of the story, he does seem to be feeling guilt in some way. And yeah, your prediction sounds like that's probably the resolution to it. But it says a lot about who he is now. And I thought a very telling line in here was when Talon was trying to help him. And she says, "Why are you doing this? You don't want to be unstuck." And I thought that pretty much mm-hmm. summed up the whole point of this season, is that Picard doesn't want to be dislodged from this place that he's put himself as a sort of a defense
right.
mechanism throughout his life based on what happened with his family.
Well, and it goes to show, too, you can't help somebody who doesn't want
right.
to be helped.
Yeah.
Picard was in that same position, really, almost as his mother. Less severe, of course, but still it has left him in a place to which, you know, he's kept everybody at arm's length. He's had a secret shame. He's had a guilt that he's never been able to let out. And that has kept him separate from mm-hmm. from everyone that he's longed to truly be close to. And it's also just kept him alone in the way that he doesn't have to be if he would let go of it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think obviously this is something to which his possibility of a relationship with Laris and all those type of things, we're really working towards that. But I love this. Picard says, "You want to pull me apart."
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what this season wants to do, is to pull him apart like silly putty and see what's in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. The difference between him and his mother in terms of wanting to be helped or not, I feel like his mother, I don't think that Jean-Luc has the same mental illness like his mother. And his mother was very much lost. There was this line early in the episode where he says, "Perhaps that's what happens when you live in a world where monsters are real." And the scenery around them is this like fairy tale and the monster outside the window and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's saying this line, but I think the point is that for her, the monsters were very real in her mind. And there's that moment later
right.
when Talon says that there was no monster chasing your mother. And his father says, no, there was. There always was. But I couldn't save her, mm-hmm. not from her own mind. So she maybe didn't want to be helped, or she was too deep into this world in her head that she couldn't be reached and she couldn't be helped. And then Jean-Luc, on the other hand, I don't know. I was just thinking, as you were saying that a moment ago, do you think that Jean-Luc over the years truly didn't want to be helped, or he was afraid to be helped? It was better to just keep this in the back of his mind and not let it surface. Maybe because he also tells his father, you were relentless, father, your cruelty, you ruined her, you broke her. And if you think about how he was always scared to get close to Beverly, which we always took as being the fact that she's under his command, but it perhaps could be that he was very scared that he might become his father if he let everything come to the surface and he really faced it all. Or at least who he perceived his father to be, I should say.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I'm not sure that he was afraid so much of becoming his father. I think he was afraid of being hurt by somebody the way his mother did hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think that this is really going to come down to some abandonment issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's going to feel guilty for having let her out of the room, but then I think that she might kill herself. Therefore, Picard will feel abandoned by his mother. And so if you never get close to anybody again, that can't happen.
Right.
Plus, I think, and not to get, you know, crazy psychological on this, but if you have that kind of mother issue, mm-hmm. as a male, it is going to be difficult for you to have a healthy relationship with someone of the opposite sex because of the fear that's going to be there if you never deal with it emotionally.
Yeah, and it might be subconscious fear, but it's there.
Exactly. And I think that's the key. I think you're absolutely right. I don't think Picard realizes that this is actually the thing because he hasn't ever truly kind of tried to understand what has kept him from being able to move forward. And this whole season, again, of thrusting him into a place to which he has to deal with these emotional issues is important, and obviously will be important to what we talked about, you know, at kind of the end of the episode with a thought of maybe how they can understand what Q wants in all of
right.
this. So yeah. I think what's interesting is that there are more connections here between what's good for Picard and what's maybe going to be good for Q are linked.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. And then lastly here, this was kind of addressed actually, what you're saying about Picard's fear of opening up to someone else. It's sort of addressed in the dialogue when the young Picard says, what if it's not different this time? What if it's the same as every other time? That's his yep. fear, right? It's always going to be the mm-hmm. same. Let's talk about his father a little bit, and also the choice of casting here of James Cowlis as his father. That opening scene where it's obvious that we're in space and we see that comm badge from the TNG film DS9 Voyager era, we hear this voice. And then in that dark, as I was joking about at the beginning of our recording today, that dark room where you can't quite see what's going on. And the fact that we had those DS9 teasers early on, and we've been wondering where that is, maybe for just a microsecond, we thought, could this be Dr. Bashir? But then we see it's actually Dr. Gaius Baltar.
Which... it's very interesting to me. Obviously, this show is helped created by Kirsten Beyer, mm-hmm. and this reminds me of Dr. Cambridge from the Voyager books, who is very blunt, very honest type of character, very much like this doctor that he's talking to here, which he, you know, in the dream there's this kind of veil that's blocking him from realizing he's actually talking to a personification of his father as the therapist, which is interesting because I think it goes to the veil that's going on with a lot of things here. We'll talk about that with Talon and being Romulan. So a lot of veils being lifted in this episode. Or to speak in Christian terms, we just had Easter, the veil is being torn finally, and people are going to be seeing what's behind the curtain. I loved this casting. I thought it was fantastic. One, because I think it very much helps with the idea that, you know, if he has this very British father, why he has the accent that he does when he spent most of his life with his father and not his mother, you know, so that's great. James Callis is a fantastic actor, you know, total reprobate as Gaius Baltar in the Battlestar Galactica series. But here I loved it. I did love, even I've heard a lot of people make fun of the uniform that he's wearing because it's not quite, it's not the Deep Space Nine uniform, right? It looks like it, but it very much feels like a dream version of something that lacks some of the dimension and the realism. It's just like a representation of that.
Which is what it is. That's what it is. It's in his mind. Come on, people. Why do fans sometimes have to get so bent out of shape about the tiny details? That's the point, is that it's not real.
Even though it's not quite as nice as those uniforms we saw like in First Contact, I was brought back to the fact of how clean and neat that look is compared to what they do now, where everything is so busy.
I think it's my favorite uniform design.
Yeah. I mean, for me, next to the Monster Maroon, there's no better uniform than the First Contact uniform. Yeah, same. So, and or DS9. So, I thought he was great. And you know, what's interesting is to see that, you know, a lot of who Picard is comes from his mother. She's the one who basically told him, you need to be a good speech maker to motivate people in times of trouble. But I think subconsciously, Picard picked up what it means to be a good father without knowing it. He doesn't realize it, but his father is actually protecting him, caring for him. And for a guy who has daddy issues, he sure is a great father figure to a lot of the other people that know him. Everybody looks at him as a father figure.
Which comes up even in this episode when Teresa says that to Rios, and Rios explains, And Girardi earlier 100%. In the season said, sometimes I wish you were my father.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think that what's going to be interesting, and if they do this well, Jean-Luc is going to come to the realization that he actually learned more from his father than he realized, and that will free him from the anger he feels against his father. And there's going to be a lot of freedom here to be the best version of himself, because I think he's actually been denying a lot of those things, and it's actually what's kind of kept him from being able to be the best version of Jean-Luc he can be, because he's wanting, as he does in the episode, as the child in the dream, I don't want to be like him. I want to be like you. Mm-hmm. What he should really want to be more like is his father.
So,
because his father was actually a pretty good person.
Yeah, I'm going to go on one of our little Niner orb side quests here for a second and just bring up the fact
that
if you look at the difference between Picard as a captain on The Next Generation and Sisko as a captain on Deep Space Nine, how he interacts with his crew, how he is able to build a sense of family, I would say, in the environment. Picard is standoffish. Sisko invites everyone to his quarters for dinner. But look at the father situation for each of them. And look at what we're learning about Picard's relationship with his father, and then what we know of Ben's relationship with his father.
Great point. It's an excellent point, Chris. And it kind of shows how important, again, that family is to us, to our who we are. Our family really helps make us. And so if you're a parent, it's incumbent to be the best parent that you can be, in the sense of really loving your children and taking care of them and helping them understand what it means to be a good human being. And, you know, those relationships are just so pivotal to who we are. And if not done well, they can be pivotal to making us lesser versions of ourselves too.
Right. If not done well, they can sometimes propel you to be what you feel your parents weren't,
mm-hmm.
which is what happened in my case, but it also can go the other way. And so as a parent, mm-hmm. I always strive to be there and be as caring and supportive as possible, in part because of my background growing up. Talking about James Callis as being cast here, I thought he did a phenomenal job in this episode because in the early parts of the episode, he plays the psychiatrist in the way that that character needs to be played to lead Jean-Luc along in this story. He listens, but he also agitates Jean-Luc. He's a bit mysterious. Yes. There are moments, if we didn't know that Q had lost some of his powers, there are a few moments where I almost feel like Q is speaking through him. But I think that the portrayal was excellent up front. And then when we get into the room, into the tunnels towards the end, the sorrow, the sadness with which he plays mm-hmm. the character, with which he delivers the lines, in particular, the ones we've already mentioned, you know, maybe I am a monster, but not in the way that you think. And also mm-hmm. that there always was a monster chasing, but I couldn't save her, not from her own mind. I just, the delivery really, really sold that part of the story. And I think that Callis was the right choice, even though at first I thought it's kind of an odd choice of casting for Jean-Luc Picard's father. But by the end of the story, I think it was an excellent choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely didn't get his father's gift of hair, but, you know.
That's true. That's very, very true. So moving along, you mentioned already that Talon is Romulan. What did you think about that reveal? Because my initial reaction was, okay, this is a little bit unnecessary. I kind of liked the idea that this person resembles Laris, but is human, and that's triggering something in Picard. Now we find out she's actually Romulan, and then Picard says, you could be an ancestor. And then I started thinking, well, okay, could be an ancestor, but is this actually Laris? I don't know. There are many ways you could go with this. Romulans do live a long time.
Yeah. I'm of the opinion that this is Laris, and that we're pulling back veils from, you know, pulling the wool up from over his eyes, yeah. finally, and helping him see things, and that this is being done on purpose to be able to give him the connection that he's going to need with somebody to be able to make that next step. And, you know, as he mentions in this episode, you know, we've just taken one major leap way past personal boundaries. And I think that's the key here. And I think that's one of the things that Q is after, right? He's after somebody finally actually knowing who he is to the core. We all want to be known and loved. To have one without the other doesn't mean the same thing to us. So for Picard to be fully known here, for the most part, we still haven't finished the story with his mother, which we'll finish, and she will then fully know who he is and will then still fully love him, will be something that I think is exactly what we are all looking for. And in the end, I'm thinking that's what Q wants too. Q has spent all of his existence not really being who he fully is for anyone, and it seems to me as if he's dying, finally, and he wants to be fully known I don't know if it's possible to fully love Q, but we'll see, you know? So I think that that's why Talon as a Romulan is going to end up being important for the story. And it would make sense to why Q kind of creating this scenario where it's this can happen makes sense then. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I'm seeing it right now. Yeah. So, but who knows? I mean, we still got three episodes and I could be completely wrong.
Yeah, sure. Well, Q creating this may be the key because I mentioned a moment ago that Romulans live a long time. So if you were trying to just purely mm-hmm. make it linear, it could still be Laris. But what I think is more likely is the fact that Q created this whole scenario in the first place and he put certain individuals here and there where he needed them. And so certainly he could have put Laris into this position to be part of this big puzzle, this big mystery that Jean-Luc has to solve. And then the real key to that, again, as we're delving into the mind, delving into these doors that Jean-Luc has kept closed, that Laris was trying to open, putting Laris in this mm-hmm. position to be the person that actually goes into his mind and dislodges him, helps him get unstuck from this thing that's been holding him mm-hmm. back all this time, makes perfect sense from a storytelling perspective. The reveal itself, I thought, was it just came out of nowhere in terms of just, well, let me show you my ear. And then the explanation is, now I can't hide my ear for 8 hours.
Well, but remember, you know, she knows what a mind meld is in the previous episode. Mm-hmm. She also, the device that goes on her ear actually looks like it is made for someone with pointy ears.
Well, that for sure.
Yeah. And she's not an elf.
Yeah. Sure.
So I think they laid a few different breadcrumbs in there for us to follow maybe this is actually a Romulan. Maybe this is actually Laris. So I'll be fascinated to see where this goes with, you know, the story and mm-hmm. how we end up wrapping it up in that side. So, yeah, I think that's, you know, this is one of those places where it's serialized television and therefore this is probably not something we'll have fully answered.
No, I don't think so. Not with three episodes.
Another couple of episodes. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I'm not too worried about it. And hopefully, like the other revelations we've gotten in this show so far, I think most of them have gotten better as we've moved forward. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that just continues. Because again, we're here at episode 7 and this season has continued to be very good. So I got to give them full props for that.
Yeah. Well, it feels like they're building towards a longer story than just three episodes left.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be clear, the fact that she's Romulan, that didn't surprise me because I've suspected for a while that maybe this is actually Laris anyway, because of the connection with Picard and the story. It's just the way that it was revealed in the episode felt kind of like sudden to me, mm-hmm. and then the explanation. But anyway, now we know that she's Romulan.
Yeah.
And now we need to find out if she's actually Laris, which does seem mm-hmm. probable in this case. Okay, let's talk about another aspect of the story, because everyone gets their own thing going here. We've talked a lot about Rios, who is your favorite character, or at least one of your favorite characters mm-hmm. from the series. And he gets a little more time with Teresa here. He's pivotal to making sure that Picard doesn't die on that table. And he makes the comment that he needs to help without breaking time. And then he has to call and have Raffi beam in this piece of equipment, which freaks Teresa out, but then he walks her through it. And then we get yet another Voyage Home reference when he says, no, I'm from Chile. I just work in outer space. And then we get more Voyage Home references here when he beams her and her kid to his spaceship to show her around. So it feels like a lot of Kirk, Gillian, Taylor vibe going on now between Rios and Teresa. And I don't really know how that connects with the overall story, mm-hmm. but I think it does play into how Rios sees things anyway.
Mm-hmm. I am wondering, I mean, are we going to kind of get a repeat of the voyage home? Do we take them with us when we go back to the 24th century, 25th century, wherever we are now? And I think that's, that might, again, that's where the thing, do you do like a Stargazer series to, you know, that's an interesting exploration, right? Because we've had people, you know, TNG even had the episodes where the people who are cryogenically frozen are woken up and then they're having to live in this, you know, place. You know, we never see Jillian Taylor again, so we have no idea what that would be like for somebody, really. So if that doesn't happen, I do see this moving Rios to a place when he gets back of maybe looking for love.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at that he is a man who has spent so much of his time being unhappy, being angry, being frustrated with some of the cards that life had dealt him, the situations that he had gotten thrust into, and that he's seen that life is more than just trying to save the universe, and it's about living. And something to which Picard is also learning. So I think that makes for a nice mirror there. But as for how that actually happens, I'll be fascinated to see how far they go with the story. But I personally am enjoying his storyline, you know, because I think it also helps connect us to the fact that what they're trying to save is the future for them as well. Not just themselves. And so we're intimately connected with people we don't want to see move into a horrible future at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I like that. I think that's good writing. You want to make us care about this time period. And that's, you know, there's another story here that's also helping us do that as well. So kind of adding a couple of different layers to it, which is great.
Yeah. I think the parallels with Picard are important, at least for me. I noticed that with the Rios character, you have someone who, something happened to him, he pulled back. We saw that in season one. Now he's learned to open up again, and now he is even open to love with Teresa. And that's something that Picard hasn't been able to do yet. So if you look at the two characters side by side, you see one character progressing while the other doesn't. And the character that's progressing is talking about how much he respects and looks up to the other character, Picard, and kind of sees him as a father figure. And then we have this whole story about how Picard sees his own father and then learns the truth and advances. And as for will they go to the future? I mean, if they follow through this whole voyage home thing that they've got going through this season as a proper parallel, they'll get to the future. Teresa will get assigned to a science medical vessel, and Rios will say, well, how can I find you? And I don't even have your number. And then she'll say, don't worry, I'll find you. And then they'll go on their own way. And then Rios will get a new ship for himself. But I don't know if that's what's going. Another way to think about it, though, I've been kind of mulling over, is that, first of all, you think, well, you can't leave Teresa and Ricardo, her son, in the past when they have knowledge of the future. You also, if you take them to the future, you're removing two people from the past, and that has repercussions. Of course, it's all interesting in her role in this story, the fact that the name of her clinic is Butterfly. And we talk about the butterfly effect, and then she's at the center of this with Rios and what's going to go on. But there's also the fact that if they solve this puzzle, which of course we know they will, if they solve this puzzle and they fix the future, then this entire history will vanish, maybe. Of course, some people may say that's not how time travel works. But within Star Trek, maybe that is how time travel and timelines work. They would be resetting things, and therefore Teresa and Ricardo would disappear anyway, And if he takes them to the future, then here are two people that will live who otherwise would not when this entire thing is over. So I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know which way they're going to go with the story. Right now, I'm leaning towards them going to the future with Rios.
So they're going to go back to the future.
That's right. They're going to go back to the future. And Leah Thompson's going to be waiting for them there.
Leah Thompson. Okay.
Well, let me ask you about this one now. That's kind of, we're talking about questions and mysteries and all, but the biggest mystery in Star Trek history has finally been solved, because since May 8th, 1989, fans have been trying to figure out why Guinan did that thing with her hands, that kind of claw, funky thing when she saw Q and Q-Who. And now we know. So, did you like this? Did you feel like this added texture to the Star Trek universe? Mm-hmm. Or was it like Enterprise with the augment arc explaining something that didn't really need to be explained?
I thought that this was an interesting way that, you know, the Elorians have this relationship with the Q continuum. And that would not necessarily be the way that they would summon a Q, but that they would be able to sense that that was actually a Q. Mm-hmm.
So each finger is like a sensor.
Exactly. Exactly. Just didn't realize that until now.
And you point it in the direction where you think the Q mm-hmm. might be, and mm-hmm. then your fingers tingle
yeah.
when you're in the right orientation.
Okay. Yes, absolutely.
Got it. I'm going to be practicing this after we record, by the way.
Yes, we're going to have Elorian classes where we will help people figure out how to sense cues and whether or not they are actually there. So look for that. It's going to be a lot of fun here on Trek FM. We'll probably do it on Zoom. So, no, I thought that was really fun. You know, I thought adding to the Elorians in this way was fascinating, the fact that they have been, we already know they're a long-lived species. And exactly how long, honestly, we don't know. But we know that they have been around long enough to have had a drawn-out Cold War with the Q, which means that the Elorians are much more advanced than we've right. ever known before.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I have no problems with this of taking a race to which we know so little about and expanding that to make it more interesting. You know, I think this is one of the things to which, you know, the Litverse has done so well. I think of, like, you know, Christopher L. Bennett type of books that have really added to the understanding of things that maybe have only gotten a reference before. He really just kind of creates this whole world. This is great. That's what they're doing here. I think that's actually one of the things that kind of helps with having somebody like Kirsten Beyer helping to create these shows, because that's, again, that's exactly what the novels do. And so for them to do that here was fantastic. I had no issues with it. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. I thought it was decently thought out. And what I'm most interested in now is to see kind of how this continues to play out and what else we might learn about the Elorians. So mm-hmm. what about you, Chris? Did you like this? Did it work for you? Did you feel like, oh, that feels a little silly?
No, I thought it was fun. I joked about, is this like Enterprise explaining something that doesn't need to be explained with the Klingon forehead ridges? But actually, I also like that Enterprise arc. I do think that it over-explains Same. Something that, as a viewer, you should be able to just say makeup and budgets were different, and as time progressed, we added forehead ridges. But they added a lot of texture to the universe in explaining how this happened with Klingons and why we see different types of Klingons, and then also adding some conflict within Klingon society because of it. And so it wasn't just a simple little explanation. And I think they did that here with the Elorians, because you point out that they're obviously much more advanced than we ever knew. The fact that they had a Cold War, especially a drawn-out Cold War with the Q continuum, means that they have to be reasonably close in powers to the Q continuum, because you can't have a cold war with someone if the power balance isn't similar enough that one side can't just simply swat the other side down. And that's something I had never considered with the Elorians. I just saw them as the species that was long-lived, had some abilities to sense things that we cannot, but I never thought of them as being on the same level as the Q. And so I would love to see this explored more and find out what happened. What was the Cold War about? How did they resolve it? And the fact that Elorians can summon Q whenever they want, a Q. I started to say Qs. It's hard to make them plural. They're all named Q. But summon them whenever they want, it kind of suggests that the Elorians maybe won that conflict. They had some leverage over the continuum in the end, which is also really fascinating to think about.
Well, and I was thinking that, you know, I think it adds texture to the idea that the Elorians, with their listening capabilities, with their senses, they have the opportunity to have a leg up on the Q, in the sense the Q can't surprise them.
Right.
You know, the way that Q can and for other races. So I think even if they're not necessarily on the same wavelength power wise, you know, part of Q's fun is to be able to show up and people don't realize that he showed up, because he can show up in any form he wants. But, you know, if you're an Elorian and you can know that there's a Q there just by doing the hand thing, kind of ruins that opportunity. And just you get this thought process that their senses allow them to be able to understand when the Q is near in the first place. So I think all that just makes for more interesting and nuanced and fun storytelling. I mean, one of the things we talk about so much and we love about Deep Space Nine is the way in which it takes races and it accentuated them in ways we never thought possible. So they're doing that here with the Elorians, and that's great.
Yeah. But I do love the fact that the entire story element is born of the fact that people have been asking all these years, why did Guinan do this thing with her hands? And then from that, all of this evolves. So it is fun.
Yeah. And, you know, they can contain entire moments in liquor bottles, which who doesn't want to do that?
Exactly. I'm just seeing a shelf behind the bar. It's like, what kind of moment do you want to experience? I've got this, I've got that, I've got that. You know, I've got that time when your favorite team won the championship. I've got it all back here. And then that guy wanders in. Before we leave this scene, I did love Patrick Stewart's forced laughter when the guy shows him the video of Picard beaming in. The, ah, ha, 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 ha. And Guinan's explanation was about the cameras going to fritz. But I almost thought she was going to say, you know, I used to have this app that could put special effects on any video you want, because in this season, they're just using standard iPhones. You just see them, you know, when Renee was texting Q, it's just like an iPhone 12.
That's just 12, augmented reality. You know? That's all that was.
I love that moment. Okay, last item for us to talk about here, and probably quickly because there's not too much of it in this episode, but Jurati with a side of Borg Queen or vice versa. When Raffi and Seven go back to the ship, Seven realizes that, okay, this encryption code is Borg. Jurati purged all the Borg code. Now it's back in. How did it happen? And then they see the footage of her doing it, and then they go and they run away. One thing I want to point out in that entire scene on the La Serena, how good is Jerry Ryan's acting? Just, I don't know, to me, it's just so natural. She has that character down so well and has evolved it since Voyager. And I loved all of the moments with her there.
I do think that, yes, she's great this season. I think part of that is the fact that she has been able to, in this century, to become more comfortable in her own skin without the implants. And it's allowed her to be able to, I think, be Annika in many ways that she never thought possible. So I think that's all great. I you know, we've talked at length in the season so far about who this Borg Queen was going to be, and is it possibly Jurati? And I think, you know, of course, this really continues that thread of that's the possibility of that's who the Borg Queen would be that's coming through the rift. And I love the way in which we're seeing kind of like the birth of a new queen here. The idea that as the queen continues to manipulate the hormonal makeup, it allows her to take over the body more quickly and therefore create what she needs. And I think this is one of those places where we've added another layer of complexity to the story and fear as to what's going to happen and how this is all going to work out. Because, yeah, creating a new Borg Queen in a place where humanity has no ability to protect itself other than this crew on the not La Serena, La Serena, it's not good, right? So I think, you know, episode 7 leaves us in a place worse than we thought possible with the threat to this century, while at the same time leaving us in a place where we feel more hopeful about the character Picard himself in a way that we haven't before. So there are those two polar opposites of feelings we're left with the episode, which is fantastic, actually, as we make our way to the last three.
Yes, definitely. And it charts two paths for humanity at this point. So they're trying to save the future by helping humanity avoid this authoritarian, tyrannical future that it's headed towards. But now suddenly, humanity might not be headed towards any future at all because it may all be assimilated shortly by this new Borg Queen. And, you know, we're reminded in the opening credits every episode of the design of that Borg ship that comes through the rift. And I believe 7 even comments on it in the first episode that design is it's Borg, but it's not like anything that they've seen before, which suggests that it has a different point of origin from all the Borg ships that we've seen in the past, which would also lend itself to this idea that Jurati becomes the Borg Queen, assimilates Earth in the past, and then humanity as Borg evolves on a different path, comes through the rift. We hear these voices asking for Jean-Luc's help, which, as I've been saying, are the voices of humanity. And anyway, that ship design itself actually may be a clue to what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, what's really nice about this series is we've set up all of these different obstacles. We're starting to pay off some of them, but we still have major ones left. And we have three episodes left to answer the questions. So hopefully we don't just lose anyone. I do think the Soongs, we don't want to lose that storyline. We need that to pay off with Q specifically here. And of course with Jurati, all of those are major storylines that we need to see pay off, as well as, you know, finishing up what we've started with Picard's healing. So
yeah,
let's land this starship, you know?
Well, those sound like your final thoughts. So my final thoughts are, yeah, I think we may have already seen the payoff of the Jurati storyline and don't know it. The Soong, that has to go somewhere. I think Adam Soong is too central to the direction of Earth's future, the fact that there's that statue of him in the bay and everything else that's going on there and how he has helped Q, definitely that's going to be coming back around. And I don't know where it's going to lead, but ultimately, I as I said earlier, I feel like they're building up these stories that feel like they will be difficult to resolve in three episodes in a fully satisfactory way. But maybe it's going to be like a Seinfeld episode where it all comes together at the end into one nice, neat little conclusion. So we'll see where it goes. And about Picard's mother, I was thinking as we were talking about that, it's going to be a wonderful topic for a novel that Una or someone can write. exploring what really happened with Picard's mother.
I mean, that's absolutely true. You know, there's definitely novels worth of material here to be able to discover and flesh out. So, yeah. And, you know, I think personally I would give this 4 out of 5 beamed in medical instruments because I was really moved by this episode emotionally, honestly, when we were discussing and especially that first watch through with what Picard is experiencing, what he's learning that he's tried so hard to forget. And I'm excited for this show. Every week, I'm excited to watch it on Thursdays. I watch it as soon as I possibly can. So,
yeah, which says a lot for the quality of the story. Yeah, I'm going to give this episode 9 neural oscillators. All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on Monsters, the Star Trek Picard episode, that is, and everything that we've talked about today. There are many ways for you to share those thoughts with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That's our closed listeners group. If you're already a member, you know what to do. But if not, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right on up. If not, just type the whole name, the Babel Conference. It is a closed group, so please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. We'll put a post for this episode there in the group, and you can share your comments with us and fellow listeners and extend the conversation beyond the podcast. You can also send us email if you prefer. Just go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose the artificial tango, and that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And of course, you can find us everywhere in social media, Twitter, Instagram, all over the place, where our username is TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not drawing all over the wall in the living room, which I know your wife really doesn't like, where can people find you?
Well, especially when I do it in permanent chalk. But you can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattRushing02, with that Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero. Of course, here on the network, we've got the whole other side of the network, not devoted to Star Trek, but just devoted to all those other fandoms we love, the 602 Club. We hope you will check that out. Of course, great bonus shows in there as well with Snyder Cuts and Assembling Avengers, all in the same feed. You can also find me doing Warp 5, The Orb, and Literary Treks. Warp 5 is about Star Trek Enterprise. Chris, you and I are talking about every single episode of Enterprise as we celebrate 20 years of that show. We've got The Orb as we talk Deep Space Nine, Our Great Love, and of course, Literary Treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, there's a Finnish show that I've got called Owl Post. Talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time, so hope you'll check that out. And then Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with John Mills. Now, Chris, when you don't have your foot stuck in a dungeon and you're just waiting for somebody to come and save you, where can everybody find you?
Well, I'm always going to be in the same place. That way people can find me. I have to make sure I just stay there.
Okay, good, okay? Good.
And I'll be there doing things on the network, like you mentioned, talking Enterprise with you on Warp 5 and DS9 on The Orb. I also have Interphase, a Star Trek Universe podcast, and Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room from time to time, and I've got other stuff going on as well. And when I'm not doing that, I'm busy with the usual work in publishing and writing and such. So if you'd like to hear my thoughts on Star Trek and other things, just check out the back catalog. And you can catch me on Twitter if you'd like to chat. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. I'd love to talk to you about Star Trek or Japan or pretty much anything, especially memories trapped in bottles in Guinan's bar. We can speculate on that. So catch me there, C. Brian Jones. Now, if you would like to help us keep this show and everything we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. If you'd like to become involved in the network, You can find out how by going to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. It takes a great deal of money to get these shows put together and out to everyone. And we could definitely use your support. And we'd like to say thank you to everyone who is supporting us right now, and especially to Cornelia Reutner, who is our associate producer here on the Artificial Tango. Cornelia, thank you so much for your support. We would not be here without you. And thank you again to everyone. Well, Matthew, I am going to try to find my way back up out of these tunnels so I can get ready for our next discussion.
Well, Chris, that sounds like a fantastic idea. So make it so.